Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Glenn Moberg, and this is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Today we are live in our Wisconsin Public Radio studio on the campus of UW-Stevens Point, where thousands of people are attending the first Joint Finance Committee hearing on Governor Walker's proposed budget for the next biennium. Over the next hour, we'll be playing some sound from the people who testified today at the hearing. We'll be talking about the details of the proposed budget, and we'll be taking our questions, your questions, for our two guest analysts, UW-Stevens Point political scientists Ed Miller and Dennis Riley. Ed Miller is also leading the conference on small cities, which is also happening on the UWSP campus today. We'll also be discussing this week's state Supreme Court race between Joanne Kloppenburg and Justice David Prosser, and late word that apparently thousands of missing votes, uncounted votes, have been found in overwhelmingly Republican Waukesha County. This is all open to your comments and questions. If you want to weigh in on the state budget, if you want to give us your reaction to the state Supreme Court race or the upcoming recall elections for both Republican and Democratic state senators, or if you want to weigh in on that ongoing fight over collective bargaining rights in the state of Wisconsin, our lines are open at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Ed Miller, before we get started on the budget questions, you are leading the statewide conference on small cities here at UW-Stevens Point. Tell us what that's all about.
Right. This year's conference focused on sustainability and environmental issues. We had a number of panels, including a national speaker who was here actually last night, who spoke about the how people interpret various environmental issues through the prism of political parties. Professor from Northwestern University, Professor Druckmann. In the conference itself, among other things, particularly for your listeners, we had a mayor's panel of Central Wisconsin mayors, and each of the mayors were talking about things that were occurring environmentally in their community, and problems with, for example, water flow, problems of flooding, and other kinds of issues. They particularly talked about not only some things to save energy, such as LED lights to be used, which apparently can save a considerable amount of not only energy but money for the communities, but they also talked about a survey that was just completed about an intercity bus system that would take people from Stevens Point, Wausau, and Marshfield to work or to school as well as the airport. And so this is in the planning stages, this particular system, which would, of course, save money. People wouldn't have to drive independently, whether it's going to the university or Marshfield Clinic.
Well, I've heard people talk about that before as kind of a pipe dream, but you're saying that it's actually close to reality, or at least they're talking about it.
Right, and they've completed the first stage of it, and it's a survey, and they were very enthusiastic about it because they mentioned there's an interrelationship between the communities and particularly among the labor force. In central Wisconsin, that new industries open up, they will be drawing workers from other kinds of communities. So it's if this can happen, it will be a much more integrating as well as energy-saving component for central Wisconsin.
Well, the show today is about the budget hearing, and you had these local officials on. How are they concerned about the cuts that are coming down to local units of government?
Right, and they're very concerned about the effects on various services that are needed. They're very concerned about the cuts on their bus systems, not only the interstate bus, city bus, meaning that I just talked about, but also the bus systems within their own communities. And they talked about various ways that maybe can be funded, because not only is there a funding cut, but the elimination of collective bargaining may result in the loss of federal funding.
In the city of Wausau, they put that question off for another year or so by passing collective bargaining agreements for their drivers before the law took effect,
right.
So that allows that federal money to come in, but they're just postponing the inevitable when the collective bargaining agreements finally go away. So does the federal money, and potentially so does the bus service, and the bus service is so important locally, Dennis Miller, with I'm getting the two of you mixed up. We don't have Dennis Miller here. We've got Dennis Riley and Ed Miller. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not Fox News. Dennis, bus service is so important in some of these cities for poor people, people who don't have cars, the elderly, the developmentally disabled who use buses to get back and forth to work. And we did hear some testimony at the public hearing this morning about concerns about the elimination of local bus service.
Right, and that would be something that would fall disproportionately on disadvantaged people in the community. There's no doubt about that. And there are a good many university students that use the bus here in Stevens Point as well. And so it really would be a shame, I think, in my opinion anyway, a shame, if we lost that system and lost that service. But without the federal subsidies and without some other funding, they can't hold it together on what riders pay. I mean, mm-hmm. Nobody can.
As two UW-Stevens Point professors, I want your reaction to a comment by Republican State Senator Glenn Grothman, who said the DNR should be hiring retired or unemployed 40- and 50-year-olds instead of hiring new graduates from UW-Stevens Point. I don't know if you saw that, but this is a quote from him. He said he was talking to DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp, and he said, maybe you should look to hire those people who know what the real world is like rather than a recent graduate from UW-Stevens Point who doesn't know what the real world is like, commenting that older workers who had been laid off would probably have a better sense of the cost to businesses that might get involved in disputes with the agency.
Yes, I saw that yesterday. He's reflecting the idea that the need for reduced regulations in the environmental area would be more understandable by somebody who was older than somebody who just graduated and had more of an environmental bent. But on the other hand, in somebody just graduating, for example, would be more up to date in terms of regulations as well as science involved. And the other question that could be raised is, are we trying to export our young people to other states? Because then they would not be able to get jobs in Wisconsin, and they would go to other states such as Illinois.
Is there a hostility toward higher education in the UW system from this administration? Some of Governor Walker's critics have made that claim.
Well, I certainly sense such a hostility. I mean, the kind of cutting that is being suggested, the general attitude toward the university system. The statement from State Senator Grothman, there's a kind of anti-science, anti-intellectual bent to it. Why do you need highly trained, highly specialized, energetic young people who've studied this? Why don't you just find somebody on the street? They'll do the same kind of job. You can't believe that unless you believe that education doesn't have a whole lot of value.
I want to start playing some of the cuts, some of the recorded segments from the testimony at today's budget hearing. But before we do that, let's weigh in on the news that we have just heard over the last few minutes that apparently what we heard on Ben Maron's show is that there are 14,000 unaccounted for votes that suddenly showed up in heavily Republican Waukesha County, which gives an 8,000 vote lead to David Prosser. Your reactions as political scientists, you ever heard of something like that before?
Well, there's some who think that's where the cemetery vote comes in Chicago on a regular basis. How many votes do I need? Oh, I just found them. But Wisconsin isn't notorious for that sort of thing. So I doubt that's what it is.
And we have a history of clean elections here.
We have a history of very clean elections. And Kevin Kennedy didn't sound, in that clip we heard on Ben's show, didn't sound as if he really understood where those votes came from either. Because he said, very pointedly, I'm waiting for that explanation too. So we'll just find out.
Well, as they say, you can't make this stuff up. But in Minnesota, they did have some issues with that, with the Coleman, you know, when he was winning and then losing, you know. So, that was a very close race that went, months, I think, before it was finally decided, essentially by the courts, ultimately, after recounts. It is a strange situation.
Well, if there's suddenly an 8,000 vote margin, I think a long protracted recount is probably not something that's in the cards in this state. I mean, it's hard to imagine them making up 8,000 votes.
Right, 200, 300, 500, sure, you're going to have a recount. 8,000, that's a lot of votes to find somewhere else after you've had the kind of count that we've already had.
Did you gentlemen expect the strong turnout, not only from liberals, but also the reaction from conservatives who voted in large numbers for David Prosser?
I did, because of just simply the amount of ads that were on TV. And the ads, the more ads that you have on the TV and more focus on the election, usually the larger vote. And I think that was hooked up also with the idea of the Walker issue. I mean, certainly there was more of an issue there. They weren't voting on just the Supreme Court decisions, which they probably wouldn't draw it as many people. So, you know, when the Accountability Board gave an estimate of 20%, I thought that was rather low.
Yeah.
And they say it was about 35%, but that's not from registered voters. 35% is all people who are over 18, and that includes people who couldn't vote. You know, they're felons or, you know, and haven't had their voting rights restored or non-citizens. So actually the turnout was probably more like 40% of the electorate. And so, you know, that didn't surprise me. And the division of the vote didn't terribly surprise me, too, only in that the state is divided about 50-50 between parties. And if you look back at the presidential years, not the last one, President Obama won it larger. But if you look at the previous presidential years, you're talking about, you know, very slim numbers difference between the presidential candidates.
Well, we've got our first phone call. Let's go to the phones. Matt Powers in Wausau. Matt, you're on Route 51. Hello, Matt. Hello, Matt. I think we've got you on the air, but apparently we can't hear you.
This budget that Scott Walker has put forth.
Yeah, just a second. Matt, can you start over again? Because we had a little bit of a technical problem here in our connection.
Oh, I'm sorry.
To Stephen's point.
I'm sorry.
Start your question over again, please.
I'm just curious who is going to pay for Governor Walker's budget repair bill. Who's going to be the most affected? Is it the poor? Is it the rich? I mean, what's your guys' take on that? And I guess that's all I'm asking.
Dennis Riley?
Yeah, well, there's not a whole lot of question that this will fall disproportionately on two sets of people. It's going to fall on public sector workers who are going to have to pay more for their pensions, more for their health care, and some are simply going to be laid off. This is not going to head off every possible layoff. So it'll fall on public sector workers, but it will fall very heavily on those people who are dependent on public services like Medicaid, Badger Care, senior care. There are a number of concerns that have been raised about what will happen to the eligibility requirements, what will happen to people since it's now being centralized toward the state. There's even the possibility of it being centralized and then privatized in terms of the claims and all the rest of that stuff. That could make a huge difference for people that are living in poverty or even close to poverty. We had created there for a while a fairly generous system, a system that did cover an awful lot of people in Wisconsin, and it sounds like that's going to be scaled way back.
Well, I sat in on the budget hearing going on here at the Quant Fieldhouse at UW-Stevens Point for a while this morning, and the overwhelming number of people testifying were concerned about cuts to education and cuts to services that help the poor. We're going to play a segment by Bruce Chopped. He is a representative of NAOMI, which is an interfaith Wausau area justice group. These are his comments from the state budget hearing in Stevens Point this morning.
As people of faith, we are speaking up because we feel a budget is a moral document that needs to represent our values. The budget is punitive toward lower income families. There are cuts in income support for the poor and unemployed. Food and nutrition assistance are reduced. Medical services, child care and in-home care for seniors and persons with disabilities are more expensive and less accessible. Taxes for low-income households will be substantially higher. These cuts do very little to balance the budget, yet they create a hardship for families. We take particular offense at the attempt to demonize state and local employees who maintain hundreds of vital community functions. Unions have helped to build and maintain a strong middle class. As Milwaukee's Catholic Archbishop Listecki has said, hard times do not nullify the moral obligation each of us has to respect the legitimate rights of workers. The budget process must not undermine the operation of schools, cities, and counties vital for middle-class families, individuals, and businesses to prosper.
Those are the comments from Bruce Chopped of an Interfaith Wausau Area Justice Group, NAOMI, at this morning's budget hearing before the Joint Finance Committee. Gentlemen, either of you have a reaction to that?
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, in terms of its impact, I mean, it's going to affect state workers, for example, quite clearly. A lot of people have gotten the impression from this campaign that state workers are very highly paid, as well as people who are teachers. In fact, the QEO, the Qualified Economic Offer, has restricted pays of teachers, this is elementary and secondary teachers, since 1993. And so as a result, Wisconsin teachers have fallen in the national rating well below average of our teachers. Similarly, in terms of state workers, not only university workers, but other state workers, have had their pay pretty much limited, although they weren't under the Qualified Economic Offer. But the increases have been virtually non-existent for at least the 10 or more years. And so this impression that the state workers, which are providing, and city workers as well, are providing vital services, including cleaning the streets, taking care of the streets, teaching, and so forth, just simply misunderstands. And not only are we talking about the teachers and professors, but we're also talking about a lot of other people at universities, for example, the custodians, the secretaries, and all those individuals, and a number of those will not be able to afford the health insurance.
Ed Miller and Dennis Riley, two political scientists from UW Stevens Point, discussing some of the testimony at the Joint Finance Committee budget hearing in Wausau today. I'm Glenn Moberg. We'll be back with more sound from today's hearing and your questions when Route 51 continues.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're examining some of the testimony at the Joint Finance Committee budget hearing at UW Stevens Point, which is still going on right now at the Quant Fieldhouse. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to weigh in. My guests today, Dennis Riley and Ed Miller, two UW Stevens Point political scientists. And Ed, you were just talking about cuts to education, so that's a good segue for our next tape. This is a couple of people who actually testified today. We're going to hear from Sarah Bringman. She's a retired Madison special education teacher, and Eric Yonke, the director of international programs here at UW Stevens Point.
I believe education is the ticket to our children's future, and I believe public education is the great equalizer. I came to Stevens Point today because of my grave concern with this biennial budget's effect on education. This budget will hurt education at all levels. $834 million in cuts to our public schools, $250 million in cuts to the university system, and $72 million in cuts to our technical college. This budget rips up the ticket to the future. My home district of Madison Public Schools will see cuts of $24 million. Cuts of that magnitude will hurt teachers, support staff, and programs. And that means our children will lose. Our children will hurt.
I'm here today to speak against the governor's state budget proposal, specifically the drastic cuts to education on all levels. As a university faculty member for 20 years, I've watched the state university take cut after cut after cut. Now, this proposed budget reduces the base for the UW System schools by another 13%. UW System is the only state agency taking that level of reduction from the last budget cycle, and I ask why. We all understand the university needs to share the burden, but this percentage cut is larger than the reductions faced by many state agencies, and some agencies are receiving increases. If the state were truly broke, then why would the Department of Administration receive a double-digit increase from the last budget and the Tourism Board receive a 7% increase from the last budget? The targeting of education in this budget proposal appears to serve some broader agenda than simply fiscal responsibility.
Eric Yonke, Director of International Programs at UW-Stevens Point. Before that, Sarah Bringman, a retired Madison special education teacher. Ed Miller, we've heard Ed Miller talk about his reaction to the education cuts. Dennis, let's get your reaction.
Well, sure. Off the top, I have two grandsons in the Stevens Point school system, and I want them to have the kind of quality system that their mother had and that their aunts had. I mean, it was a so much better system. It's been cut and cut and cut. That is, as the teacher from retired teacher from Madison pointed out, the public education system in the United States, and in particular in states like Wisconsin, has always been the key to social mobility, always been the key to a better life for the next generation. And if you've got public education, higher education, K through 12, if you've got that, you take away the rungs on the ladder that people have used to move up for generations, and that's just a dangerous thing to do, and yet we're out there doing it. But we've got $300 million extra for roads. We just have to cut $900 million from education for the $300 million for roads.
Well, the argument, again, is that we've got a $3.5 billion problem here, and it's got to be fixed somehow.
We do, but it's approximately 1.5% of Wisconsin's annual income, that 3.6 that we have to find. About 1.5% of what we make as a state in a year. Now, I'm not saying let's whack everybody 1.5% on their income taxes, but Minnesota bumped some income taxes, Illinois bumped some income taxes, and I don't see mass exodus of folks coming from Minnesota or Illinois to relocate to the land of fiscal sanity. I mean, we just have to understand that they've got to be done on both ends of the budget.
We're talking to Dennis Riley and Ed Miller. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. The subject, the budget testimony before the Joint Finance Committee. More after this news. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We are live today from our studio, our Wisconsin Public Radio studio, on the UW-Stevens Point campus, where the Joint Finance Committee hearing on Governor Walker's proposed biennium budget is still going on until 6 o'clock this evening. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guests today, Ed Miller and Dennis Riley, two UW-Stevens Point political scientists, and we are taking your phone calls at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. If you've got any questions or comments about the proposed cuts to local governments, to public schools, to the UW system that are in that budget, if you've got questions about that, or if you've got any comments about the ongoing fight over collective bargaining rights in the state of Wisconsin, if you've got questions about the protracted Supreme Court race between Joanne Kloppenburg and Justice Prosser, who apparently just picked up 8,000 votes that had been unaccounted for in Waukesha County. Give us a phone call, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Our lines are open. Do you think that four official public hearings on a document that's going to affect as many people as this budget, do you think that's enough?
No, I think there needs to be more. And actually, I think it needs to be more in depth. First thing is that they should have divided the budget up into different sections of the budget so that you would have a hearing on each of the sections that would focus on it rather than the full budget. The other thing, the budget's a real problem anyway, because most states do not do a budget like Wisconsin does. Most states have a budget which is a financial document, and the individual program changes are done outside the budget in individual bills. Wisconsin rolls them all up into one. issue. So one of the problems is you don't know what to focus on because there's so many different things. So at least they could divide them up. And the other thing is, rather than giving somebody 2 minutes, you know, and seeing, you know, many people during the hour, that becomes during the day, that simply becomes more symbolic than having any real impact and providing real input to the legislators.
Dennis Riley.
Yeah, that Ed's right about that. That's exactly what happens, and you could see it. I was only over there for about an hour or two, but you could see it and hear it in people just, you know, they've got 2 minutes, they come in, they tell their own personal story, it takes them their 2 minutes, and they make their one little pitch for one thing or another thing, and it was pretty disjointed, and it didn't give a clear focus, and I think Ed's right, a different kind of hearing would give a much better focus.
And they were really strict with that 2 minutes. They had a little egg timer up on the podium, and when that 2 minutes was up, that egg timer started beeping, and there was really no way to get a comment in edgewise over it. What about the timing of these hearings? Why would you have a hearing that starts at 10 in the morning and ends at 6 o'clock in the evening, right about the time that working men and women might be able to show up? The hearing's over.
Same reason you have elections in the spring and call them nonpartisan, to reduce the number of people who actually get to participate or feel motivated to participate. It's not exactly a conspiracy, but sure, they knew that they would get fewer people and possibly a slightly different group of people by holding them during that particular time frame.
And you also notice that, although there is one in Stevens Point, that most of the other hearings are held in relatively small communities. I mean, Stevens Point's not huge, but, I mean, it's bigger than some of the communities. And several communities refused to hold the hearings because they were fearful of the number of people who would be in their community. So we have a small community. We can't accommodate that.
There's no hearing in Madison. There's no hearing in Appleton. There's no hearing in Rhinelander, although the state senator there, Jim Holpern, is holding a hearing with other Democratic state senators. So, yeah, only four hearings. Total on a budget that's going to affect an awful lot of people.
Right, and if you look at congressional hearings, for example, if you want to use that as a comparison on a much narrower bill, they hold many more hearings than that.
Yeah.
Than four hearings, and so essentially it's a symbolic exercise, and they'll probably vote mostly on party lines.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to weigh in on Governor Walker's budget or the fight over collective bargaining in Wisconsin. Our lines are wide open. You can get in right away. We're going to play a cut right now by Village Administrator Dean Zuliger of the Village of Weston. He testified this morning. And, Ed, I'm particularly interested in hearing your reaction to this because, of course, you've been hosting the Conference on Small Cities here at UW-Stevens Point. His proposal, Mr. Zuliger's proposal, is that the state should force local communities and municipalities, villages and cities, to cooperate with one another and also to cut their own budgets. This is Dean Zuliger at this morning's hearing.
We believe that this budget only serves as a Band-Aid approach to municipal government. If the legislature does not deal with a complete overhaul in a manner that removes duplication of effort, layers of regulatory burden for both the taxpayer and our valued business community, and streamlines delivery of essential services. So I'm here to talk about doing some serious surgery rather than a Band-Aid approach to this budget that reconstructs government at every level and reduces the tax burden on our citizenry. In business, it's called lean, and in the government form, it comes in two parts. First, I'm asking this policy committee to mandate that by 2014, all levels of government in Wisconsin adopt lean principles of management that reduce 5% of their baseline operating budgets based on their 2012 budgets. And I'm asking that you adopt statutory language that ties implementation of lean principles to the amount of shared revenue a community may receive. I'd also ask that this committee include an amendment to this budget that creates a lean government commission similar to what our neighbors in Iowa have successfully implemented to promote and oversee government efficiency efforts. Second, I'm asking this policy committee to mandate that all local levels of government be engaged in a consolidated or shared service arrangement with an adjoining government by 2014 and put the same shared revenue cuts in place if they don't do that. The problem that we have here is parochialism, turf battles, those kinds of things.
And you heard that egg timer there at the very end of Mr. Zuliger's comments.
Well, it's very interesting because that was the community that pulled out of the bus agreement with Wausau. and you know, so he wants the cooperation, but not with the bus system. But also, Weston is also the community there, and several times where I've been involved in some discussions of consolidating services, it's people in that area and some other areas surrounding Wausau who have been most adamant about not going in and sharing services with Wausau for fear that their taxes are going to go up and they would receive less services.
Well, he mentioned an agreement that they tried to have with the city of Wausau regarding a shared fire engine that ran into all kinds of back and forth between who was going to get the engine, where it was going to be stored. Having talked to Dean Zuliger before, I know it's a matter of frustration for him that they can't get these kind of cooperative arrangements with the area fire departments going, similar to the D.C. Everest Police Department, which has shared services among Weston, Schofield, and Rothschild.
Right, and Mayor Tipple had actually mentioned that at the conference, and the concern that they were worried about, as he said, what name was on the fire truck. He said, as far as he cares, as long as they can save money, he doesn't care what the name is on the fire truck, as long as they will come out and put out the fire. But he said some other communities were concerned about these items. But we've been doing this for a long time in Wisconsin, trying to push consolidation of communities. The Kettle Commission, most notably, advocated a lot of integration of services, and we've had very, very little. School boards, for example, school services probably should be integrated. We have way too many school districts for the number of people in Wisconsin, number of students in Wisconsin, but it's very hard to get any consolidation of school districts. We've gotten one in the last 20 years.
What about his proposal that these local units of government either do cooperate and do start sharing services, or they see, say, a 10% cut in shared revenue from the state?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a stick to do this.
And the carrot, conceivably, is lower property taxes.
But you're going to have difficulty in getting people, and what you're going to wind up doing is you're going to cutting revenue and cutting services to people who really need them. That's whose services are going to be cut. And, you know, it's not good. I mean, you cut ambulance services and fire services and things like that, and as well as other kind of social services that are provided.
Dennis Riley, I want you to comment on something that was given to me. This is a breakdown of how the budget bill, the biennial budget, would affect counties, and particularly county programs, county-administered programs that help the poor. This is an analysis by Brad Carger of the Marathon County Administrator. He says that eligibility determination for income maintenance groups, Medicaid and food share, will become centralized, automated, and transferred from the county to the state. The intention is to contract with a private vendor for the service. And he says this raises four issues. First of all, the ability of the vendor to deliver a quality work product. Say it's Hewlett-Packard, which has tried to do some of this administrating in other areas. Also, unemployment costs associated with the dislocated workers. Right now, the county pays the cost of unemployment compensation on a dollar-for-dollar basis, and they've got 26 full-time employees in the income maintenance unit in Marathon County to do that. A loss of indirect program administration funds, and that would lead to also almost a $500,000 reduction for community AIDS allocation. The whole idea of taking some of these things, taking them from county administration, moving them, centralizing them in the state, and then having a private company administer them.
Yeah, that's going to bother an awful lot of people, I think, precisely because we are a little bit different in some parts of the state than other parts of the state. We feel we have different needs and different talents and capabilities. And we'd like a little bit of autonomy in making the determinations. Maybe we want to tax ourselves a little bit more so that we can provide ourselves with a little bit better set of services. And another county might not wish to do that. I know the state is always nervous about too much decentralization to the counties because they're afraid that services will be uneven and all that. This doesn't appear to be based on that, but it appears to be based on we want a lower, a different standard of eligibility. We want fewer people to be made eligible statewide, and we're going to take control of this. Then we want to continue with our privatization process. And that's a very scary thing, because privatization hasn't always worked the way its advocates suggest. It sometimes gets things out of public control. It's harder to monitor. It doesn't always end up like Halliburton, but it can. And so it's a kind of scary thing to put that much power in private hands when it's public resources.
John Nichols, who's a liberal commentator, a writer for The Nation, has written a column decrying what he calls the loss of local control, the attack on local governments. In other words, the state pretty much cuts aid to all of these local governments and then tells the governments they can't raise taxes locally in order to make up the difference. Why not give local governments the ability to fund things that might be important to the local people?
Because I don't think they particularly want those things funded. I mean, I think there's an ideological vision in some segments of the Republican Party. I mean, I won't tar them all with the same brush, but an ideological vision that says there's an awful lot of what government does that it shouldn't be doing, and the best way to not do it is to centralize it here toward us, and then we won't do it, rather than leaving these counties that sometimes are willing to do things.
My understanding as a kid who grew up in a conservative Republican household is that you're supposed to be stressing local control, bringing government down to the local level, as close to the people and local units of government as possible. So why do we have a conservative government in Madison that's doing exactly the opposite?
Right, and I think that was Dreyfus's point of view when he was governor, that he emphasized local control, and he used to say, you know, who has the gold makes the rules. And so, therefore, he didn't want the state to do this, and he wanted the local government to raise money, including school districts, as well as to spend money. I mean, that was a Republican point of view, as you mentioned. But I think what Dennis has said is absolutely correct, that they would like to simply cut the amount of money, not let you raise the money, and push you into the corner. It's called the starve the beast kind of mentality.
That was Grover Norquist's famous analogy. Get the government small enough so that you can drown it in a bathtub. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to weigh in on the budget battle, the testimony that's going on at UW Stevens Point regarding Governor Walker's proposed biennium budget with Ed Miller and Dennis Riley, two UW Stevens Point political science professors. Our lines are wide open. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back with more after this.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station. Thanks very much.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. That number again, 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to comment on Governor Walker's proposed budget, the state Supreme Court race, or the fight over collective bargaining. Ed Miller and Dennis Riley are our guests. I'm going to play one more cut from the budget hearing today. This is a gentleman, Randall Chevalier, who is the chairman, the tribal leader of the Menominee tribe, talking about the amount of poverty on his reservation and the fact that he doesn't want the government to cut basic health services, including mental health services.
We are one of the 11 Wisconsin tribes. Our tribe has over 8,500 members. In addition to being members of this tribe, we are also proud members of, or proud citizens of the county of Menominee, as well as citizens of the great state of Wisconsin. Our residents are some of the poorest people in the state. Over 32% of our members live below the federal poverty line. Our county ranks 72 out of 72 in health factors, including mental health care. One of our greatest challenges is in the areas of funding mental health services. As Mr. Wapichick pointed out, we have been working cooperatively with the county of Menominee as well as the State Department of Health and Health Services to fund these essential services. Between the county and the tribe, though, we just do not have the financial resources to cover all of these costs.
That's Randall Chevalier, the Menominee tribal chairman. We hear so many stereotypes about how wealthy the Indian tribes are now that we have the casinos, but apparently poverty is still a pretty serious problem.
Right, and it highly varies by tribe as well.
What could you say to somebody, you know, who's concerned about mental health issues and health issues in general on a reservation?
I wish our colleague Elizabeth Wabandato were here to speak to that, because she is an expert in these kinds of things and a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. But clearly, any time you start touching on the questions of health, and Ed is a real honest to goodness expert, so I'll let him come in here in just a second. But anytime you start talking about those things, you're in such a tangled web of service delivery and paying for the services. And there's the Indian Health Service, there's the county, there's the state, there's the national government. Are we going to have a health care reform law go survive or not? We have so many difficult questions. And in a rural area like that, just a sufficient number of providers to deal with people becomes a very serious problem.
Yeah, and, you know, you can speak about health, but you can add the whole thing together, as we've been talking about. Health, education, bus systems, all of this are significant for economic development. So when they're looking at cutting taxes to try to encourage businesses to come in, I think they're being very short-sighted, that businesses look at the infrastructure, they look at the quality of the social services, the quality of education before they come in. In the Center for the Small City, we do get calls occasionally from businesses that are interested in locating in Wisconsin. And the question that they always ask me is, they don't ask me much about workers or even the taxes. They typically ask about education. That's number one. How is the school systems? Because they are coming in with families, and they're concerned about that. If our school systems are declining, as they are, and will be, and with less funding, I think we're going to be less attractive to businesses moving in, regardless of the taxes.
Now, Scott Walker is not the only Republican governor in the Midwest who's trying to enact some fundamental sweeping change. We've got Rick Snyder in Michigan, John Kasich of Ohio. Of course, Chris Christie in New Jersey has sort of set the template for them, and Rick Scott down in Florida. Why are all of these Republican governors all on the same page, all doing the same thing at the same time?
Well, that is the current Republican Party ideology to a very substantial degree. Again, Grover Norquist, cut it down, cut it down, cut it down, and we will not raise revenues. So if you're not going to raise revenues, it's pretty easy to cut government, because government's already a little bit in the hole anyway. So if you don't raise revenues, it's going to have to shrink, and that's the plan, and they are all on that page about it. Now, some people probably feel that there's a couple of brothers behind it all. I don't think it's quite that simple. These guys are on the same page. They really believe that the public sector should be shrunk.
Well, there are people with a lot of money who are willing to put that money where their ideas and where their passions are. Do you think it's likely, given the number of signatures that would have to be gathered, that Scott Walker faces a recall election next year?
I don't think so.
Well, I think that they will get the number of signatures. I think the governor of California who was recalled is Gray Davis, right, is a precedent that you can do it. Now, whether he'll win a recall election, that's another story, because I think the election right now with Prosser and Kloppenberg is illustrative of that. So he may win the reelection. I just have this feeling that they will be able to get enough signatures. Of course, that's a couple months off, and we don't know what's going to happen, you know, there. But if it were happening today, I think they could collect signatures.
There are now recall efforts underway for 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats. 2 of them have been filed. Randy Hopper was the latest, and Kapanke prior to that. Do you think any of those recall elections will be successful?
I think there's a real possibility they will. And I think what happens in those will dictate in part whether there's the momentum for the signatures to try to recall Scott Walker. If all of those, if all the Republicans that they get the signatures for win their recall elections, that'll take a lot of steam out of it. But if those people are recalled and the state Senate starts to look different, then the momentum might come and they might be able to do it.
And I should point out, if the state Senate does change, it's going to have a tremendous effect on redistricting, because with Republicans in both houses of the legislature and the governor, redistricting is going to make the state a much more Republican state.
Julie Lawson and Jim Holpern, also 2 local Democrats who are targets of a recall effort. What are the likelihood of those recalls succeeding?
I don't think there's any chance for Lawson.
But Holprin.
Holprin's a possibility.
Yeah, I think that's quite correct.
And we are out of time. Dennis Riley, Ed Miller, thanks so much for being with us today, and I'm sure we will be revisiting this issue as long, divisive summer
Thank you.
You know, winds out ahead of us, because Wisconsin is certainly a place that is making national news, and it will continue. We want to thank today's guests, UW-Stevens Point political science professors Ed Miller and Dennis Riley. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, director, and engineer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jake Clotty. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next Thursday at 5 on Route 51, we'll be taking a closer look at the specific ways in which the governor's budget proposal will affect county and local governments. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 p.m., on the Ideas Network stations. A reminder, you can follow our adventures on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Until next week, we are heading out of town.